This is audiobook in MP3 of War Letters from the Living Dead Man, of Elsa Barker, London, 1916. War Letters from the Living Dead Man. Introduction. In the spring of 1914 there was published in London and New York a book of mine called Letters from a Living Dead Man, being automatic writings from an American judge and teacher of philosophy who had been known to his intimate friends as X. There were circumstances connected with the writing of that book, explained in some detail in the introduction, which made any other hypothesis than that of genuine communication from the other world seem untenable to me. It began, for instance, some days before I knew in Paris that my friend had died on the Pacific coast of America. In that first book of X I did not state who the writer was, not feeling at liberty to do so without the consent of his family. But in the summer of 1914, while I was still living in Europe, a long interview with Mr. Bruce Hatch appeared in the New York Sunday World, in which he expressed the conviction that the letters were genuine communication from his father, the late Judge David P. Hatch, of Los Angeles, California. For the benefit of those who have not read the former book, I wish to say that X was not an ordinary man. He came nearer than any other accidental of my acquaintance to the mastery of self and life which has been called adeptship. After the letters were finished in 1913, during a period of about 2 years I was conscious of the presence of X only on two or three occasions, when he wrote some brief advice in regard to my personal affairs. On the 4th of February, 1915. In New York, I was suddenly made aware one day that X stood in the room and wished to write, but as always before, with one or two exceptions, I had not the remotest idea of what he was going to say. He wrote as follows. When I come back and tell you the story of this war, as seen from the other side, you will know more than all the chancelleries of the nations. This letter I confided to two friends who had been much interested in the former book, Mr. and Mrs. Vance Thompson, and it was arranged, with the cordial consent of X, that they should sit with me about once a week, to make a better focus. Their loyal faith was a great support to me during the first half of a trying labor. The writing was not confined to the days when we three sat together, but about a third of the first half of the book was written in the presence and in the house of Mr. and Mrs. Thompson. Then they went to California, and I continued the work alone. It may be of interest to some readers if I describe the process of this writing, which has changed gradually from a violent and mechanical seizure of the hand from the outside, as in the beginning of the first book, to a quiet impression on the mind within. If the reader will imagine a well-known friend of vivid personality present with him, then subtract from that impression the seeing of the physical eye, leaving only the subtle vibration of the actual thinking and feeling presence, then add the indescribable inner sight, he may begin to realize how I know that X is in the room. It is probable that Helen Keller knows when her friends are near her, and can tell one from the other, though she is deaf and blind. When made aware of the presence of X, I take a pencil and a notebook, as any other amanuensis would, and by an effort of will, now easy from long practice, I still the activity of my objective mind, until there is no thought or shadow of a thought in it. Then into the brain itself come the words, which flow out without conscious effort at the point of the pencil. It is exactly as if I heard the dictation with a single auditory instrument, like a small and very sensitive sphere, in the center of the brain. I never know at the beginning of a sentence how it will end. I never know whether the sentence I am writing will be the last or if 2,000 words will follow it. I simply write on, in a state of voluntary negativity, until the impression of personality described above leaves suddenly. Then no more words come. The writing is at an end for that time. The question will naturally arise in the mind of the skeptical reader, it is in mine, whether my own subconscious mind has not itself dictated the following war letters from the living dead man, in the attempt to explain a world tragedy which would have seemed impossible 2 years ago. But from my long experience in writing for X, and from the fact that during 2 years I had not written for him except on two or three unimportant occasions, though often thinking of him, and from my acquired habit of minute observation of supernormal phenomena, I now feel safe in assuming that I know the difference between the actual presence of X and my own imagination of him, my reminiscence of him, or even the suggestion of his presence from another's mind. No person who had even a minute fraction of my occult experience could be more coldly critical of that experience than I am. I freely welcome every logical argument against the belief that these letters are what they purport to be, but placing these arguments in opposition to the evidence which I have of the genuineness of them, the affirmations outweigh the denials, and I accept them. This evidence is too complex and much of it too personal to be even outlined here, but the letter 36, written 1 hour after the sinking of the Lusitania and 9 hours before I knew of it, is merely one incident out of dozens. Also, it may be considered at least an interesting coincidence that at the very time I began writing this book, three occult students, in different countries, wrote me that they felt that X had come back and would write again through my hand. Since then, several other persons have so expressed themselves by word or pen. Many of the events of this war and myself have seen astrally at the time of their occurrence. I was a wide-awake astral participant in the first action in which the British Army was engaged on the continent, and related the experience to a British officer in England before it was reported there, my narrative being verified the following day by a French newspaper brought over from Paris by a friend. I saw in New York the shelling of Scarborough at the hour when it occurred, and related the incident to a friend some hours before it was reported in the newspapers, though I did not know the name of the English coast town where I had seen the assault. Nevertheless, I cannot read what is in the mind of X even when I am conscious that he is actually present in the room. I know only what he dictates, and have no idea how much or how little he knows. He has stated in one of the letters that he should tell me only what his judgment approved from time to time. There is one point where I myself do not quite follow X. Sometimes when he says that the German people are so and so, had I been writing I should have said the Prussians. I have many German friends, and I cannot hold them individually accountable for the awful conditions into which their government has plunged the world. I must emphasize that I do not assume personal responsibility for what X writes, but merely record his words. It did not occur to me until several days after his last letter was written, on July 28, that he had finished the war book exactly 1 year from the date of the first declaration of war, that of Austria against Serbia, and on the very day when the Pope sent out his great appeal for peace. In his former writing, which began more than 3 years ago, X requested that I should never summon him, and later advised me not to ask questions. I have therefore generally refrained from doing either, though the temptation has often been great to ask him as to the final issue of this war by which I have been so profoundly affected. But I knew that such questioning might stimulate the action of my own objective mind and becloud my receptivity. I have recently shrunk from seeking for such answers even in my hypnagogic visions, lest I should see something which would make me less negative in the reception of these letters. This situation seems to have cured me forever of curiosity. It has made me feel detached as a comet and almost as lonely, and strong enough to be willing to remain so. But, by a strange paradox, as my hatred for the brutalities of this war grew deeper and deeper, my love for all those struggling human souls in every camp grew with it, until I came to feel that each one of all those millions who died and suffered on those battlefields was my brother and my friend. Love is a miracle that touches the brutal facts of life and makes them divine. In the third letter of this book, dated March 10, X said that the forces of good had overpowered the forces of evil and that peace would return to the world, though he did not say when. Before I learned of the Lusitania sinking, but 1 hour after it had actually taken place, he wrote that the demons whom the workers out there had driven back had rallied and returned to the assault, and that he ought to have known that the very law of rhythm would drive them forward again after they had generated another supply of energy. In the light of rhythmic law, that letter is to me the most interesting part of the book. It illustrates what he has said so often, that even the living dead do not know everything, and that the reason why they know so much more than we do is because they have a wider vision and a greater fund of data on which to base their conclusions. In regard to that second onslaught of the powers of darkness, it is perhaps significant that the letter describing his first conversation with the Dark Veiled One was written next before the Lusitania letter. Aside from his narrative, two major ideas seem to dominate X in this writing: the mystery of good and evil, love and hate, and the brotherhood of man. Through his soul-changing exposition of the conflict between good and evil, both in the human heart and in the universe, a man might learn to protect himself against his own evil as well as the evil outside him. In pursuit of this end, X has revealed certain mysteries to which the attention of the common man has not heretofore been effectively called: that there is an astral world permeating and extending beyond the world of dense matter has been stated in theosophical and other literature. X makes his readers realize the fact. The astral world is said to be the world of feeling and desire, and it is through a man's astral, feeling or desire body, made of a tenuous kind of matter invisible to untrained eyes, that he connects with and functions in that world. Within and beyond this again is said to be the thought world, and the theory is that man has also a thought body through which he contacts with and functions in it. And so on, plane after plane, till man reaches the formless and universal, in other words pure divinity. The evil astral beings described by X are beings dwelling in the astral world. Some of them have no physical bodies in the material world, others are the more or less independent astral selves of men, which during sleep go here and there in the world invisible to our open eyes. They have been active in this war. There are also said to be beings of the elements, earth, air, fire and water, who are evolving along a line different from that of man. Some of these are amiable, some are malicious. Much information about these elementals can be found in the writings of Paracelsus. They also have been active in this war. Other and superior beings work on all three planes, physical, astral and mental, and in still higher worlds beyond our cognizance. But for the beneficent activity of some of these, mankind would destroy itself or be destroyed. X says that the feelings of hatred and the sufferings engendered by the Great War have made the astral world at this time a very unpleasant place of sojourn. The purgatory of the Roman Catholics is the same thing as the place of post-mortem trial described by X. The Church has great knowledge. Good and evil may be called opposite and complementary forces, one working in harmony with the law of the universe, otherwise called the will of God, the other working disharmoniously with the law. Some readers may be shocked by what X says of black magic. He is not writing to shock them, but to protect and instruct them. Superstition has been called the dark side of religion, but superstition is to be understood, not dismissed with the lifting of superior eyebrows. All things are to be understood. The great psychologists, scientists, do not now consider these subjects beneath their investigation. Refer to Professor William James, to Sir Oliver Lodge, to Dr. Barry Duke. The names of recognized scientists who are now investigating occult phenomena would fill a small directory. When I admit that I am seeking to chart the unseen world, I am modestly enrolling myself in good company. X speaks of the Dark Veiled One who inspired Nietzsche in the misleading of young Germany. Perhaps behind every powerful man or woman whose work has told in the world there has been an invisible one, either light or dark veiled. The question is not without interest, both practical and theoretical. Inspiration, like magic, may be either black or white. The voices of Jeanne d'Arc would in our day be called clairaudient phenomena. History declares that they rendered her more, not less, efficient as the savior of France. Martin Luther threw his inkpot at the devil, but the Reformation was no less ably engineered because Luther had visions. Saul of Tarsus also had a vision, if we may credit the reporters. X speaks of his own teacher, a master. When I compare the California judge whom I knew with most of the men and women with whom I prattle about commonplaces, I do not find it difficult to admit the possibility that man may progress even further than X, given the resolution so to do. If X became what he was in a little less than 70 years, there is hope for us who look forward to eternity. The second major idea of these war letters seems to be the brotherhood of man. The world has progressed thus far through a series of well-marked periods, and by means of a series of predominant races which stamped their time with their own peculiar color. X says that a new race, the sixth race so-called, is about to arise now in the United States. If America would accept this idea as a working hypothesis, not another Deutschland über alles, but say America for, not over, all she might build a peace machine as Germany has built a war machine. If she should go about it with the same thoroughness, postulating the ideal brotherhood as Germany has postulated world dominion, she might make a demonstration in the next generation. In the mixture of races in America, she has all the materials for any kind of spiritual experiment. Asia and Europe would look on with interest. England, Germany, and France, even Japan, who is spiritual underneath and material only on the surface, perhaps Russia above all, would respect such an avowed purpose. It may be that the world will have suffered enough by the end of this war to be ready to welcome universal brotherhood. Already there are movements in America which would gladly fall into line. X speaks of the Woodcraft movement, a loosely organized body of perhaps 100,000 men and boys and a few women, who in their playtime have gone back to nature and the campfire for that fraternity which cities do not give. X says that he has another service to perform in the future. I do not know what that service is, nor whether I have any part in it. But if he should one day declare to me that it was in connection with the Woodcraft purpose, I should not be surprised. But after living for months with this war book, I cannot yet see it in perspective nor gauge its value. I give it to the world because it seems to belong to the world, and because among the thousand letters which I have received from the readers of Letters from a Living Dead Man, so many have asked for further writings of X. The first book is now being translated into four European languages, and other translations have been offered. I want to thank all those persons in many countries who have written me so kindly about the book. It was more for them than for myself that I embraced the offered opportunity to hear what X had to say about the Great War, to receive genuine communications from the other world. Assuming as I must that such communication is possible, involves sacrifice on the part of the amanuensis, even in the protected quiet of a country home. To do it in a great rushing city like New York, amidst the distractions of a complex social life, and during a war like this by whose horrors the sensitive is especially buffeted, and in a clashing pro-German pro-Allies environment, has been an education in self-control. But the war cannot last forever, and someday joy will come back to the world. New York, September, 1915. Elsa Barker. Letter I. The Return of X. In a faraway star I heard the command, go back to the earth, and learn the mysteries of love and hate. I did not know to what I was going, but went as commanded. As I neared the earth, an army of angry beings sought to bar my way. What are you doing here? They cried. This is our field, and we brook no interference. I called to the teacher, and he stood beside me. Even he was grave at the power of the forces before us. It has come, the teacher said, it has come suddenly, after a long preparation. Wrath is a cosmic force, and hate is a cosmic force, and love is a cosmic force, and fear is a cosmic force. Did you think that love was a pretty sentiment? Did you think that hate was a mere annoyance? I have seen the sources of wrath and hate and love and fear, and that my experience may be of use in helping men to understand the forces working in and behind the race, I have made the effort to write for the world again. This war is more than a war of men, it is more than a war of angels. Its roots are in necessity itself. A new race has to be born. And races like men are born in the pain and the blood of their predecessors. But as the curse of Eve came through her listening to the envious serpent of evil, so this curse has come upon the world through mankind's listening to the suggestions of envy and hate from the forces of evil within and around the world. I have seen those forces in forms, I have faced them and wrestled with them. I am strong because I have struggled. I came back to the world nearly 5 weeks before war was declared on Earth, but war was already declared in the spaces above the Earth. As the nations had long been getting ready their forces, so the entities outside were ready and in arms. The demons who met me, for they were demons, had triumph in their eyes. A beginning had been made, a seed of anger sown in the heart of Austria. And the seed was watered in the ground by those who felt that their harvest was approaching. You must understand that evil is coexistent with good so long as the egos of men evolve. The forces of good and the forces of evil are complementary. They are in actual forms, they have acquired egos, their concentration on their work would shame the greatest geniuses among men. But they too are consciously or unconsciously servants of that cosmic will whose designs we call the will of God. I have learned much since the days when I entertained you with stories of the newly dead who had died serenely in their beds and had gone out into the astral world as into an adjoining room. A million souls have gone out recently, shocked, torn, mangled, buffeted by their own hate and the hate of those who sought to destroy them. Pity those who have died even tranquilly during the last 8 months. They have passed through a region of torment, those who have passed through. Many have remained below, spun round and round in the whirlpool with those who died by war. Had I not a great purpose, and the conviction of a great mission, in thus revealing the secrets of the other world at this time, I should not harrow your feelings by a recital of what I have seen and sometimes taken part in since my return from the journey among the stars. Comfort yourself, if you need comfort, by my assurance that the race is passing through a rite of initiation. Those who have died in the service of an unselfish enthusiasm will in time rebody themselves and reap on the earth the fruits of their service. But not all who have died have been filled with this enthusiasm. Many have hated for hate's own sake. They are the ones who have failed. Pity them if you must, but it is better not to think about them. They are the willing victims of the demons who sought to bar my way, when I was commanded to return to the world and learn the mysteries of love and hate. Love. Yes, there has been more love born of this war than the earth has known in all the 2,000 years of Christianity. For the human race is awake at last, and that it may not go to sleep again is my purpose in once more breaking through the wall that separates me from you. March 5, 1915. Letter 2. A dweller on the threshold. There was one demon who seemed to be a leader of demons. He was unlike many of the others, more personal, more egocentric. As we stood opposite each other, I entered into conversation with him, partly to satisfy my curiosity, partly to throw him off his guard. "Who are you?" I asked. "You seem to be a ruler among your kind." He straightened himself with pride. "I am indeed a ruler," he said, "a ruler on earth and up here." "On earth also?" I queried. "Yes, also on earth," he answered, "for I am the deeper self of a man who is great among men, a man who will follow my will as others follow his will." Then he made a claim which startled me, and I forbear to repeat it. "If you are the evil self of a man still living," I demanded, "how do you stand as a separate entity up here? How are you apart from him?" "You are somewhat ignorant," he said to me. "I am ignorant of many things," I admitted. "Instruct me in any way you can. I have a thirst for knowledge." "Know then," he said pompously, "that I broke away from the earthly form that had enchained me when he acknowledged my rulership and worshipped me as his genius." "He set you free?" I asked. "He set me free by acknowledging me as his master. His knowledge is even less than yours, and he called me by a name that I despise, but so long as I rule I care not the name I rule by. Or I care little," he corrected himself. "But such things as these are too deep for you." "I am deeper than you think," I asserted, "and I have met your kind before. My kind may be, but not my equals. I am a king among spirits." "I had observed your crown," I said, "it has a familiar look." During this colloquy the teacher had stood silently by, but now I turned to him with an unspoken question. He led me aside a little way, and said, "When a man exalts himself too much, he sets free the demon within him. He often thinks that he rules the demon, and sends him on errands through the invisible, but it is really the demon who commands, and the commands of the man are only echoes." And it took this vision of hell to teach me that. I exclaimed, "What you would have learned in due time by reason or by precept, you now learn by example," the teacher said. "You have truly beheld the evil self of a great ruler. It is very powerful," I admitted. "It will grow in power for a time," the teacher said, "and then it will go to Jaina." "And when will it go to Jaina?"
"When peace returns to the world, after the war is exhausted up here. But the war will be exhausted up here before peace returns to the world."
"What war is about to be fought?"
I asked.
"The greatest war of all time," the teacher said, "the greatest war of all time up here, and also on the earth."
"And when will it begin?"
"It is already begun here, as you have seen. Had you not been far away, you would have known it before."
"I have indeed been far away," I said. "An angel has shown me many stars, and I have learned much."
"The angel kept you away from the world until you should be strong enough, and rested enough, to work as well as learn."
"And where does my work lie?"
I asked.
"In many fields," he answered. "But first you must fight your way through the astral world above Europe and save your friends who are in danger." Swimming the Hellespont was a minor feat compared to swimming that sea of devils, but I got through. A year before I could not have done it, perhaps, for the forces of good were overpowered. There is a tide in good and evil, as well as a tide in the sea. Evil was at the flood. I saved one friend in danger, and saw that another was safe. Back in the sea of hate, when I was nearly exhausted, the beautiful being, that angel who had been my guide so long, came and whispered something in my ear. It was a spur to ambition. "You may be the historian of this great struggle," it said, "if you do not fail in your tasks. Do not be startled by the word ambition. There are many kinds of ambition, and a sincere wish to be personally of service may as well be called by that name as by any other, if there is love behind it."
March 6th. Letter 3, Unassurance. Take it from me, at this early stage of our writing, the forces of good overpowered the forces of evil a month ago, and the issue is settled here. The power set in motion will spend itself, and peace will return to the world.
March 10th. Letter 4, The Way of Understanding. Before I tell you any more horrors, I want to assure you now that out of those horrors will come a beauty such as the world has not known during this cycle of existence. It will not come at once, for many adjustments will have to be made, but the way is open already for those who choose to walk in it. It is a curious commentary on unregenerate humanity, this war in which each side declares loudly its own righteousness and execrates its opponent. As in all quarrels, there is more wrong on one side than on the other, but the side which triumphs, and it will be the side that is least wrong, will have to understand and to forgive its enemy before it can go forward to its own great future. Though international organizations have failed for the time being, I am not discouraged about international organizations. They were merely shocked into failure, the peace people, the socialists, and others who make far higher claims to the ideal of universal brotherhood. Even now, during the stress of the conflict, go out yourself in thought and in love to that nation which you feel to be your enemy. Try to understand it. And do not try to understand it by telling yourself that it is evil. That is not understanding. There is evil in all men. Try to understand it by becoming it, for the time. Put yourself in its place. Feel as you would feel if you stood alone, even though by your own fault, with the whole world against you. You draw back a little with the thought that you could not have placed yourself in a position where the world for its own protection would be obliged to range itself against you. But are you sure? By entering the consciousness of that nation, you are placing yourself in such a position, and I tell you to do it temporarily, in order that you may be a center, a beginning,
an infinitesimal part of that international comprehension and pardon which must become general to a degree before the long-heralded and always misunderstood universal brotherhood can even begin to find room for itself in this unbrotherly world.